guess we got to begin. We were really, we're towards the end of the sefer, although we're going to go backwards eventually. And we're looking at Perek Lamed. And I apologize for repeating, but it's been so many weeks that sometimes I have to go over it. And that is, Perek Lamed is only one Perek of Mishalim that are not of Shlomo HaMelech, but it's of somebody that is called Ogur bin Yokef. Now, just to remind you, there is a machlokes, Rashi and the Gra, other shitas as well. What is Ogur bin Yokeh? According to Rashi, based on the Medrash, Ogur bin Yokeh is just a pseudonym for Shlomo. It was another name of Shlomo HaMelech. And Ogur bin Yokeh is a symbolic name, and Ogur means to gather. Le'agor is a biblical verb, which is the same as Le'asof. In fact, the book of Mishlei uses, just again, I don't expect people to go bucky in every word in Mishlei, but in the very famous mashal about the ants, right, countless in the olden days, even in the public school system, teachers always would quote not in your time already, but even before, there's a, go to the ants, sluggard, right, go to kind of learn from the ants about how to be industrious. So the lashon that is used is, Oger Bakayetz Lachma. It gathers in the summer its bread to be able to take care of itself in the winter. So Oger is Le'asof. So according to Rashi's interpretation, Ogor means the person who has gathered a lot of wisdom. Bin, as opposed to Ben, does not mean son, but he then tries to understand it. And Yokeh is to vomit. He then regurgitates it, meaning take it in, understand it, and teach it. Right, that's Rashi's process. According to Rashi, Ogur bin Yokeh, and it was just a quick chazara, is none other than another name for Shlomo HaMelech, who not only gathered wisdom, but also tried to understand what it could mean. Because once again, knowing a lot of facts, and this is true in every area of life, and certainly in Torah it's emes, you know, you could know Dalet Chelke Shulchan Aruch literally by heart, with all the mefarshim. And you wouldn't necessarily know how to paskin a shaila because you would then have a question about an internet or a computer.
Well, it's not. I've gone through the Dalet Chelke Shulchan Aruch, and there's no reference to internet in there. Right?
And the answer is, without Havana, you can't paskin. I mean, Rabbi Yachiv used to say, Rabbi Yachiv, Zatzal, you know, he was a dayan for many, many years. He was the head of the Basin of Yerushalayim, and that was his job, actually, for the past 30 years. He technically was in retirement, although I mean he was not taking up 24 hours a day. But his job, when he worked for a living, for a salary, was he was the head of the Beis Din of Yerushalayim, which is a rabbinate position, by the way, but this is what he did for 25 years. And after he left it, however, the rabbinate still relied upon him for, I mean, not in the end years, but relied upon him to test people who would be suitable for dayanim positions. It's a very, you know, it's a demanding position. And Rabbi Yachiv said that he often got two different types of candidates, both of whom were mitzuyanim. There were people like who knew everything. They knew every sif katan and chayshin mishpats. Anything you mentioned, they would know exactly, you know, where the sif katan is. But then there were people who didn't know, and they would look up things, but they had a yisaitistika understanding of the area of halacha. So there were details they didn't remember. They knew they could look it up, etc. Rabbi Yashiv held that the second category was more valuable, would be a better dayan than the first category, because the first category is wedded to so many specifics. So if anything came up which is exactly like the case in the Shulchan Aruch, they'll be able to know exactly. But that's not what happens. In life, you know, you don't get your shailas to tailor fit the Shulchan Aruch. You got to try to figure out how to apply the klalim to the case. So that really is a question of Havana. That's why you sometimes hear people make a dichotomy between Lumdus and Psak. They say, I want to learn for Halacha, I don't want to learn Lumdus. I mean, there's some truth in this, the way we do Lumdus, but in reality, real Psak Halacha requires that a person have Lumdus, because if you don't understand the Yesod HaDevarim, you won't really be able to paskin anything beyond what is Beferish. What is Beferish, okay, if you have a good memory, you can paskin what is beferish. But, you know, very rarely, I mean, you know, it's good. So you'll know if you skip Yalav Yavu and Rosh Chodesh, you'll know what the halach is. But in a complicated shaila in Ishas or Chayshin Mishpat, you cannot never get something that's buffet-ish. So it's, do I compare it to this? Do I compare it to that? How do I combine these different halachas that seem to move in opposite directions? So without lumdus, you simply don't really know how to do that. That's why the greatest Gedolei HaPoskim were not people who just memorized many halachic sources, although they did that as well, but people who understood the svar. So that's the idea of agor and bin. Agor is to gather a lot of chachma. Bin is to understand it. That's the what we call lumdus, whatever it is. And yakeh is the other chiyuv of a Jew, and that is to teach what you know. And it's even described as regurgitating. Now that may be a little unpleasant, regurgitating is to vomit. But maybe it's expressing the idea that when a person should have so much of a desire to teach Torah that you literally cannot hold it in. Like vomiting is something that's involuntary usually. So the concept would be, it should be something ideally that's exploding inside of you that you want to share. What do Chazal say? Chazal say it a little differently. They use a nursing analogy. They say, Yoser mima sheha egel rotzel linik para rotzel lahanik. More than the calf wants to nurse, the cow wants to nurse, wants to give milk. And that's kind of the idea that a person should desire to teach Torah. Now, on whatever level it is, again, teaching Torah doesn't have to be you're giving a share, even to your own child. In fact, it's a nice story. I heard both Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is, you probably don't hear much about him here, but he's a chashuv Rosh Yeshiva, Talmud Chacham, who's the head of Gush, which is a Dati Liumi, you know, Yeshiva, but it's a good Yeshiva. So he used to live in Katzimon, although the Yeshiva was in Gush Etzion. And at night, in the Katzimon Shtiblich, have you ever been to the Katzimon Shtiblich? It's one of Yerushalayim sites, it's one of those. It's not like Zichron Moshe. Zichron Moshe in Geula has minyanim probably 21 hours a day. They tell me that between 2:30 and 4 a.m. there's no minyanim in Zichron Moshe. But 21 hours a day there's a minyan, like, for sure. You know, and probably if you really needed one, they'll get you a Maariv thing at 4 o'clock in the morning too. Katzimon Shtiblich isn't that much the same, but it's also a shtibl that has minyanim and shiurim for most of the day and, you know, well into the night. So Rav Lichtenstein was learning with his son at night. So somebody went over to him and said, "Gee, I'm very impressed that a Rosh Yeshiva, head of a big yeshiva, makes time to learn with his son." So Rav Lichtenstein said, and he's 100% correct, is, "What do you mean makes time to learn with my son? The Torah says there's a chiyuv v'shinantum l'banecha. A father is mechuyev to learn with his son. I make time to have a yeshiva too." That's not the pshat. Learning with my son is a secondary thing. So when we talk about, you know, every person who's able has to be a teacher of Torah, I'm not necessarily saying, I mean, a person shouldn't feel I'm a failure, I'm a flop, you know, if I'm not head of a yeshiva. I mean, you know, your own family is also Talmud Torah. In fact, it's a very, very important inyan. But the idea would be that if you love Torah and you love Hashem, you want to share the Dvar Hashem with other people as well. So, again, this is by just way of digression. So according to Rashi, again, Agor bin Yakeh is nothing more than a pseudonym for Shlomo HaMelech. The kasha is, so why does that pseudonym only appear here? In other words, why, you know, why is he, you know, why do you switch names? Why is he called Shlomo in the rest of the Sefer, and he's called Agor bin Yakeh here? That's a kasha. Rashi doesn't address it. But the Vilna Gaon says an interesting chiddush, which is an interesting, you know, modern type of thought that you wouldn't necessarily connect to the Gaon. He says, you know, he says, Mishlei doesn't have to have a single author. In other words, just like Tehillim. Tehillim, we say David HaMelech. But, you know, Chazal themselves say that there are kapitlach of Tehillim that were written by 10 other people. Mizmor Shir Leyom HaShabbos, according to Chazal, was Adam HaRishon. We have Tefila LeMoshe, Ish Elokim, Chayres Moshe Rabbeinu's Tefila. We even have Tehillim that seem to be after David HaMelech. It depends how you understand it. Let's say Shir HaMalos. I mean, there are 15 Shir HaMalos, but let's say the Shir HaMalos that we sing before benching on Shabbos. So what does it say? Shir HaMalos, B'shuv Hashem es Shivas Zion, when Hashem returned the captives of Zion after the 70 years of exile. Hayinu kecholmim, it was like a dream, right? It's describing the joy of returning. Now, L'chaira, That happened 70 years after the Korban. David HaMelech lived before there was a Beis HaMikdash. How do you understand Shir HaMalos? Now, there are two ways of learning. Some people learn Shir HaMalos was a nevuah, that David with Ruach HaKodesh saw the return from the Golas, and David was able to write it. But that's one way of learning. But some learn not that way. Some learn, no, this was a later psalm. Al-Naras Bavel, the same thing. In other words, do you look at all of these things as nevuahs? Or do you say that when Chazal teach us that David HaMelech is the author of Tehillim, it means he's the primary author of Tehillim? And that's what the Gra says here. And Ein Hachinami, other people with Ruach HaKodesh, you know, added later, Al-Pi Nevuah, Nevi'im, and the like. Right? So we're not Mechuyiv. You're not Mechuyiv to assume. I mean, Chazal don't assume that David HaMelech wrote every single one of the two. In fact, by Hallel, we see Pateret, by Hallel, which... Logically, by the way, there's nothing in Hallel that we couldn't say David HaMelech wrote. I mean, Hallel would fit. And yet, the Gemara in Pesachim says that the Kapitlech of Hallel were said by the Yidden by Kriyas Yamsuf. Much earlier, right? The other way around. So the Gra says, when we say for Tehillim that David HaMelech wrote it, we mean he's the primary author, but the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who made the final decision, what is part of Tanakh and what is not, They incorporated other things that they considered to have Ruach HaKodesh or Nebuah, and they put it in. So in Mishlei, the Gra says it's exactly the same thing. That although Shlomo HaMelech is the primary author of Mishlei, Mishlei are aphorisms, are sayings that help a person live a good life. So Shlomo HaMelech is the main author of them. But Chazal put in as a nispach, as an appendix, so to speak, various other collections of proverbs that they considered to also be with Ruach HaKodesh. Anything that wasn't for Ruach HaKodesh, they didn't include. That's why there's another book. This is a book in the Svarim Chitzainim. Svarim Chitzainim, well, I don't know if the English is going to help you, or the Greek, it's called the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is these are various books that Chazal determines. I mean, they're very old, but Chazal determined they don't become part of the Tanakh. And Chazal used the term Svarim Chitzainim, the Book of the Maccabees, Sefer Chashmonaim, which is the main history of Hanukkah, is in the Apocrypha. Now, in the Catholic Bible, I don't expect that you, any of you have a Catholic Bible, I hope no one has a Catholic Bible, but in the Catholic Bible, in addition to the Christian Bible, which is not relevant to us, in their Old Testament, in the Jewish part of the Bible, they include the books of the Apocrypha. So if you take a Catholic Bible, you will actually see the Book of the Maccabees. But in a Protestant Bible, and certainly in our Tanakh, these are separate Svarim. These are called Svarim Chitzonim, the external books. Say again? I'm not sure. Arsamech has all sorts of surprising things, but some of it is in offices. You know, we don't trust you guys to... All those things, but I mean, you can get it on the internet too for free. Now, let me just say something about. Let me explain this because Svarim Chitzainim. I'll digress a little bit because maybe just helpful for your ideas here. Svarim Chitzainim includes a pretty large number. Like there are like 30 Svarim Chitzainim. 30. Yeah, the Apocrypha, we call the Apocrypha. There are 30 books in the Apocrypha. I don't know if my number is exact, but it's a large number of books. Now, some of the books are historical, such as Sefer HaMakabim, the Book of the Maccabees. Some of the books are philosophical. They contain hashgathas. So when Chazal say in Maseches Sanhedrin, that goes Rabbi Akiva, a person who reads Svarim Chitzainim does not have a share in Olam Haba. So the Gemara, of course, is aware of the Svarim Chitzainim, right? The Gemara says, you know. But the point to say, the Rishayim say the following, this is an important chiluk. When Chazal say that the Svarim Chitzainim, if you read them, not allowed to read them, they don't have a share in Olam Haba, that is referring to the Svarim Chitzainim that express Hashgavas, that are philosophical books, because they contain various deist principles. Remember, Svarim Chitzainim were written around the rise of Christianity. I mean, that was around the time. So there were Minas and Kfira and different Hashgavas that are connected to Chazal, and that's why Chazal paskened that even though they look like perhaps they were written as holy books, we don't consider them as holy books. But the Svarim Chitzainim that are simply historical, like Sefer HaMakabim.
What else? Huh? What other books are historical?
That's around the main, that's the main one. I have to go through the whole list. But Sefer HaMakabim, the Rishayim, Rashi and Ramban, they quote Sefer HaMakabim. All right, so when Chazal say Svarim Chitzainim, Eino Chelek L'Olam Haba, it doesn't mean everything that we call Svarim Chitzainim, but it means things that were excluded for philosophical reasons.
Is that in general philosophy?
Well, that's true, but we have exceptions, meaning there is a general halacha, there is a general rule that Sifrei Kfira and Minas, not all philosophy will follow that.
Jewish philosophy.
Well, that's a separate issue, but that has nothing to do with it. The whole exclusion of Svarim Chitzainim was, it wasn't considered Jewish philosophy. And if you ask me, can I learn Mor Nebuchim of the Rambam, that's a separate shaila, that's a separate question. But the whole problem with Svarim Chitzainim is that Chazal determines that the philosophy they expressed was not an authentically Jewish philosophy. It was like, in the same way, you would say, Reform philosophy, right? It was done by Jews, but it's not, it's not a Jewish philosophy. All right, so that's one thing you have to know. Now, but in the Svarim Chitzainim, this is an interesting thing I want to tell you, in the Svarim Chitzainim, there is one sefer that Chazal actually do quote. Now, Chazal don't quote the Book of the Maccabees. The Rishayim quote it. But Chazal do not quote anything from the Apocrypha except for one sefer. And that one sefer is Sefer Ben Sira. You may have heard of him, the 11th paragraph of Sanhedrin. Now, Ben Sira was the man. He was the mechaber of the sefer, Yehoshua Ben Sira. And Ben Sira is almost a twin of the Book of Mishlei, superficially. Ben Sira is a bunch of sayings about how to serve Hashem, and etc. And Chazal did not consider it to have kefira, but they didn't consider it to have Ruach HaKodesh, meaning it was just the work of a wise person, and therefore it's not in the Tanakh, but Chazal quote it. Chazal do quote it, so Ben Sira is quoted. What's interesting is Taisus and Chagiga brings a strange medrash, which is not in our regular medrash. Literally, what is Sira? Sira is Aramaic for a pot, a seer. Now the Torah uses seer. So a pot or a basin, a big basin. So listen to this wild story. The story goes, Ben Sira was the son of Yirmiyahu Hanavi through a woman that was Nisabra Biambachia. Because it's even hard to explain, but the story basically is that Yirmiyahu went to a hot bathhouse and there was some zera that went into the water, and the warm water keeps Shichva Sarah alive. And the woman then used it after him, and she got pregnant. It's a case of what we call artificial insemination. She got pregnant from the Zera in the water. So Ben Sira is considered to be the son of Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So because of that, he was Zeichet to great Chochmah, but he wasn't quite the Navi. In other words, because of the unusual circumstances, he wasn't that. So this is brought down in the Paiskim, the Halacha, as one of the Rayas. It's all Shaila. If a woman gets impregnated through artificial insemination, is the child considered to be the child of the sperm contributor? Is there paternity when you don't have a pregnancy according to the normal way? So the place can bring the raya that you see that Ben Sira is called Yirmiyahu Hanavi's son. So you see that Nisabra Biambati is benai l'chaldar. So they actually bring a raya. Yeah.
Is the person a
monster
if the lady pregnant?
Well, if the woman is not married, the kid couldn't be a monster. But yes, the woman's right. So this was a famous, I'm getting far afield here, but this was a famous machlokes between Rav Moshe and the Satmar Rebbe. In the 1960s, if a married woman got impregnated through artificial insemination from a donor. So the Satmar Rebbe says that's considered adultery, so she's not allowed to stay married to her husband, and the child that is born is a mamzer. This is Satmar Rebbe, Satmar Rebbe's psak. Rav Moshe wrote four tshuvas, in which Rav Moshe says it's not shayach mamzeris unless there's a bia of iser, And if there's no Mesa Bia, there's no Mamzeris. And whatever Satmar was, the Hasidim were very infuriated at Rav Moshe Paskin connected the Rebbe, so they burnt him in effigy. You know, they did different. Burning an effigy means you make a picture and you burn it, like a picture of somebody, you burn it. They were involved with Rav Moshe tremendously. So Rav Moshe issued a very strange psak. No, I don't know what this psak means. The psak is, Rav Moshe said the following. Rav Moshe said, I withdraw my psak, but it's not wrong. I don't even know. I don't even know what that means. He actually said, everything I said is right, but I withdraw it. All right, so whatever. But this was a famous mitzvah. But if the woman is single, it's not shayach. It won't be mamzeres, because even if she had relations with a guy, unless it was her brother or her father, there wouldn't be a mamzer there. Now, why am I bringing? I totally forgot. Why did I bring? Why did I want to bring this in? Yeah. Why did I want to bring in Ben Sira? Why did I bring? Oh yeah. So here's the story. The story is this. So Ben Sira and Michle are very similar svarim in Teichim, but Chazal were mavchin in a way that maybe we can't tell what had ruach hakodesh and what is just a musar sefer. A musar sefer is a chashuva thing too, but it's a sefer of chachma. So Ben Sira is a sefer of chachma. Michle is a sefer of ruach hakodesh. So they include, according to the Gra, Ogur bin Yaakeh, because although Ogur bin Yaakeh is not Shlomo HaMelech, but he fell on the Ruach HaKodesh side of things, otherwise unknown to us. So the Gra is introducing a new person that we know nothing else about. A new person, a great person, who's called Ogur bin Yaakeh. Right? So this is a Machlokes Rashi and the Gra. One thing about Ben Sira, I want to tell you a little bit of, I don't want to say trivia, but it's an interesting little bit of knowledge. All of you remember, of course, we have Perlman's beautiful davening in the Avodah of Yom Kippur. After we go through the Kohen Gadol, leaving the Kodesh HaKodashim, we have a section of the Machzor which talks about how beautiful, how radiant the Kohen Gadol's face was when he walked out of the Kodesh HaKodashim. It was like the sun, like a chazan, right? All Marek Kohen, all the beautiful. And then we get into the mood changes very abruptly because we've reached the crescendo of joy, and then we say, now, look what we have. It's a deliberate like. And then we go into Golos and Chorban, and you know, we remember all the things we don't have. So one could ask Akasha, L'chaira, during the Bayis Sheni, most of the Kohanim Gedolim were Rishoyim. Most of the Kohanim Gedolim, they often died. Maybe they didn't die on Yom Kippur. Contrary, this is also another misconception. People think that if the Kohen Gadol wasn't worthy, he would die in the Kodesh HaKodashim. And people bring a statement that there was a chain or a rope around his leg that they have to pull him out if he died. The emphasis is the Zohar does say that, but the poskim say, according to Halacha, that can't be right, because for a very simple reason. No Kohen is allowed to wear anything extra when he does the Avodah. If a Kohen wears a tie or gloves or a sweater, the Avodah is pasul because that's called Meruba Begadim. He has too many Begadim on. So Alfi Halacha, it wouldn't be shaykh for the Kohen Gadol to wear a rope around his leg because that would be a Meruba Begadim. So
it could
what,
be after, yeah. after he died, they threw it in. They threw in a rope to like latch him out.
That could be. That's not what the Zohar says. Zohar says he entered with the rope, right? Of course, it's pretty hard. What you're describing is pretty hard to do. He's in the Kodesh HaKodashim, and okay, maybe if Esav could shoot a bird or whatever it is, shech the bird, so he could do that. But what many Mefarshim say is less dramatic. They basically say that Bederach Klal, the Kohen Gadol, didn't die on Yom Kippur itself, but Bederach Klal, he would die that year, meaning he was allowed to finish the Aveda. And then he would die in the year, whatever. In other words, not that he would die in the Kodesh HaKodashim itself. But be it as it may, the Kohanim Gadolim were not tzaddikim at all, many of them. I mean, Shimon HaTzaddik, you had a few, but most of them were not. There were 300 Kohanim, more than 300 Kohanim Gadolim in 420 years. And Shimon HaTzaddik was a Kohen Gadol for 40 of those years. Yechanan Kohen Gadol was a Kohen Gadol for 80 of those years. So 80 and 40 is 120. Subtract it from 410. How much do you have? So basically, the average Kohen Gadol was less than a year. If you had more than 300 in that number of years. So what is this big deal about the Machzor saying how wonderful the Kohen Gadol looked, you know? So I came across this. In the book of Ben Sira, interestingly enough, the end of the book describes Shimon HaTzadik when he left the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that part of the Machzor is based on Ben Sira's description of Shimon HaTzadik. So it's very interesting. The Paitan later, the poet later, made it a poetic description of what the Avodah could be. But in actuality, it's based on Shimon HaTzadik. So actually, there's part of the Machzor that's based on the book of Ben Sira. But be this may, as I say, Ogur Ben Yaka was considered to be Ruach HaKodesh, and it makes it. Ben Sira is a book of Chachma, and it does not make it. Now, I mentioned, just to finish my little digression about the Apocrypha, the Svarim Chitzayim. So really, I've mentioned three types. We have historical books, like, say, for a Maccabim. We have religious books, which Chazal considers to be largely Sifrei Kfirah. And then we have Ben Sira, which is a book of Musar, like Mishlei, which although it's not Ruach HaKodesh, but Chazal did use Ben Sira as a source of Chachma. Now then there's something else. In the Apocrypha, there are Haisafis to Svarim of Kitzvei HaKodesh. For example, they have additional Prakim in Megillas Esther. Now, which means Chazal had to decide what part of Chazal did editing. Chazal had to decide what part of Megillas Esther is authentic and what part was a Haisafa. Right? So they actually extricated psukim that they deemed were interpolations. Again, Chazal had to make this kavias. Now, what's fascinating is this. One of the most famous things about Megillas Esther that, you know, we always talk about on Purim is that the name of Hashem is not mentioned in the Megillah. Right? It's an amazing thing. The name of Hashem is not Megillas Esther. And we talk about it all the time, that that's a raya to the hidden miracle, the Nes Nistor, right? That Hashem is not revealed. So it's interesting that in the apocryphal Megillas Esther, there is a long tefillah of Esther Hamalka before she goes to Ahasuerus. And of course, Esther Avada did pray, right? But to put it in the Sefer, in which she uses the shame of Hashem many times. So you would think, gee, that's the kosher part of the book. That's the most from part of the book, right? That's the Haredi part of the book. No, Chazal were koveya that was a fake. Somebody added that later to make it maybe a more externally religious book. But Chazal were bedafka koveya that does not belong. That is not part of the Megillah. And they took it out and they put it in the Svarim Chitzayim. Okay? Yeah. Well, this was the job. This was one of the great jobs of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, because there were a lot of different books floating around there, a lot of different books. People wrote different books. You see, now, the Sefer Torah, we had an unbroken Messiah, but for Nevi'im and Ksuvim, there were other books out there as well. And Chazal had to determine. No, I'm talking about written by Jews. Chazal had to determine which books were authentic, which books were MS prophecies, which books were not true. That's why you find in the Mishnah, right? You find in the Mishnah itself, machloksim, if certain books were considered Kitzvei HaKodesh. Right? Yecheskel, the Gemara says that there were many Chachamim who didn't want Yecheskel to be included in Kitzvei HaKodesh. They wanted it because there are statements in the Navi Yecheskel that all peep shot contradict Halacha. So they wanted a Paskin Yecheskel was a Navi Sheker. They're looking at the book. So the Gemara gives a story. Hananya ben Chizkiah locked himself up in an attic with 300 barrels of oil. Today we would say 300 pots of coffee, but whatever, in other words, oil, as it were, to try to understand, and worked out, and he worked out understandings, and Chazal were convinced. So there have to be Ipsak. You don't realize that there were many. I mean, imagine, you know, you're in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. I mean, you're confronted with like 100 different books that claim to be religious teachers of things. So there has to be a psak. What is Al-Pi Nevuah? What is Al-Pi Ruach HaKodesh? What is a sacred Chachma? What is Kefira? What is Minas? Actually, there actually was a psak, meaning the what's called the canonization of Tanakh was not finally settled till Kimat the Chorban by Hashemim. Now, again, this was never a suffix. There was never a suffix in the Sacred Torah. The Sacred Torah is the Sacred Torah. So halachas were halachas. We're not talking about that. But in terms of the Supreme Nebu, it says it was not a Dover Pashat.
So why do we go Sparim Chitim and just throw it out?
Well, they did. They did. Chazal didn't make it. Sparim Chitim is not something... Chazal didn't regard it as a collection. Sparim Chitim just means any Sparim that are not included in Kisvei HaKodesh. Later, they other people collected them. That's what I'm saying.
Of the four categories, which are considered the ones that person can't
read? Mainly, it's the Sifrei Kfirah. Now, even then, let me explain. You know, there's an organization you may have heard of, Jews for Judaism. Jews for Judaism is an anti-missionary organization because there were Jews who were nimshich to Christianity, and this was designed to get them back. So the head for Jews for Judaism, or the founder, he's not doing it anymore, is a fellow Rabbi Mati Berger, who teaches at Eish HaTorah, but he's from Baltimore. I know him from many years. So he loved to debate missionaries. I hate to debate. I would never debate a missionary, but he loved to, you know, a missionary wants to show him a discussion of Isaiah, so he loves to discuss. So he says he got it from his mother. His mother used to, you know, when people, when the missionaries would ring the doorbell, you know, she would invite them in and argue with them for 3 hours. Okay, yes, that's okay. Some people can take that, some people can't, but okay. But the thing is that in order to do his work, in order to point out the weaknesses, in fact, Rabbi Lazarus here does the same thing, to a lesser degree. He felt he had to know the Christian Bible, to know what Christianity said in order to point out the flaws in it. But the question is, to read the Christian Bible, you're reading really Sifrei Avodah Zarah, the New Testament, yeah. So he had a hetzer, the Rabbanim that he asked said, he's mitzvah for him, because Chazal themselves say, it's brought down in the Rambam, that if a person needs to read Sifrei Kfirah in order to expose the fallacies, the mistakes in their arguments, one is permitted to do so. Right? So, like anything else, you can read that part of the Apocrypha if you're combating philosophical ideas, you need to know, etc. No, so whatever the heter would be for general Sifrei Kfirah, you'd have a heter for that as well. Okay. Which one? I didn't hear you say that. No, but that's really not the same. I mean, no one says bright. I mean, bright. The word brisa does mean chitzoni. You're correct. But there's no negativity to it. We don't say, oh, you're not allowed to learn brises because they weren't included in the Mishnah. I mean, most of the Gemara is based. It's a good question. Either Yehuda Nasi, again, remember the Cheshbon. Torah Shebal Peh generally was not supposed to be written down, but it was Eis Lasei Shlashem. So he only wrote as much as you needed to be able to reconstruct. So he didn't write everything because his Bedafka was said to be an alpine. Later, the Torah felt he had to write it down. And also, the halacha, you know, we may not pass on to Brisa, but it's a double question. The Gemara uses Brisas every daf of Shas. The Gemara uses Brisas to explain Mishnayos. So the chisaron or svarim chisaron, and we vada don't apply to a Brisa per se. All right, so that's a little bit about what the Apocrypha is. Interestingly enough, the Ramban in the Hakdama to the Torah has a long, long passage that he quotes from the Apocrypha, particularly a sefer that some might have classified as a kfirah site, but it's called a sefer called Chachma Shlomo. Again, Chazal determined it was not written by Shlomo HaMelech, but it was ascribed to Shlomo HaMelech. And the Ramban quotes a long, long passage about the amkus of the Torah, the depth of the Torah, the beauty of the Torah, which he quotes it from the Apocrypha. So it's interesting that you see that the Mishnayos, we're familiar with it. Okay, so be it as it may, this is going back to the Pasuk. This is just a long introduction as to Agur bin Yoker. And again, he sends his message. This is said to be a letter to Isiel. And then it says, Isiel v'uchal. So again, let me point out, Rashi and Rambam follow their respective interpretations. Since, according to Rashi, Agur bin Yotah is none other than Shlomo HaMelech, so it's a symbolic name. Similarly, Itiel and Uchal are simply symbolic names. Itiel is Itikel, God is with me. V'uchal, and I will be able to accomplish everything. Meaning to say that Agur bin Yotah is adopting as his motto that when Hashem is with me, I am empowered. Meaning to say, a mensch has to believe that with Siyata Deshmaya, there are no limits to what you can accomplish. Again, that's Rashi Lishitaso, that these are symbolic names. But the Gra, right, the Gra who learns, there actually was a person called Agur bin Yotah. So he learns, Itiel v'Yuchal are simply the disciples, the Talmidim. In other words, we're given some information which I guess may have been very useful to people who lived at that time, who might have known who these people were. To us, it doesn't really tell us a lot because we don't know who any of these people were. But it says, Agur bin Yotah sent a letter containing this wisdom to two Talmidim. One Talmid's name was Isiel, just a name, Isiel, and the other Talmud's name was Uchal. That's how the Gra learns, right? So no particular embellishment. The only thing he explains is, why does it repeat Isiel's name twice? Which is a question Rashi does not address. It says, this is Li'Isiel v'Uchal. Unless you assume there are two Isiels, you know, say two Talmidim with the same name. So the Gra says the following. The Gra says, the Cheshbon is the following, that of these two Talmidim, Isiel was much more chashuv. He was a much greater, either tzaddik or Talmud Chacham, than Uchal. So it wouldn't be derech eretz to address both of them at the same, because even if he would have said, I'm sending this letter to Isiel and Uchal, that wouldn't have shown Isiel is more chashuv. You got to mention somebody first. But by mentioning Isiel separately, he's saying, you are deserving of getting this mitzad yourself, but in addition, I'm sending it to you as a group. Right? So the Gra says it's simply an indicator of the extra chashivas. And he brings a similar Gemara, although it's not exactly the same, in Maseches Derech Eretz, which has, I guess so many associations. What is Maseches Derech Eretz? So here's something. Again, you've probably come across it. In the standard Shas, at the end of Maseches Avodah Zarah, but there's no reason why it's there, it's just there because printers put it there. You will notice, you know, there's Pirkei Avos, and then there's Avos Rabbi Nosson, and then there's a bunch of things, Maseches Sofrim, Maseches Derech Eretz Rabbah, Maseches Derech Eretz Zuta, Maseches Kala, Maseches Gerim, Maseches Avadim. These are not printed like Gemaras with Rashi and Taisus. They're printed like the Tosefta. They're just blocks of text with maybe one Beirish at the bottom. Now these are what you call Masechtos Kitanes. They are called the small Masechtos. Not forget, Pirkei Avos is a Maseches of the Mishnah, but Maseches Kitanes, Maseches Sofrim, right? Maseches Derech Eretz, Maseches Kala. What are these exactly? You know, even in the Daf Yomi program, we don't learn them in Daf Yomi. Right? They're not part of Shas. So in reality, Maseches Kitanes are not really Masechtos of Shas at all. They are collections of teachings of Tanoim and Amoraim, but they were gathered together in the time of the Gaonim. So a lot of them are taken from Gemaras and other places, taken from Brises that are quoted. In other words, they're not original texts, meaning to say these are anthologies or collections of the time of the Gaonim to deal with certain topics. So as a result, the Masechtos Kitanos are not really part of Shas per se, but again, they are teachings. And the Gaonim apparently had brises that some of which we've lost. So there are going to be brises there that we don't have in any other source. So the Gra brings from Maseches Derech Eretz that when people would send a message to Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Nasi, and to the whole Sanhedrin, they would say, Shalom Aleichem Kulchem v'Rabban Gamliel. We want to send shalom to all of you and Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel is included in all of you, but the answer is since he's Mechubad, he has to be mentioned separately. So too, ECL is mentioned separately in order that he shouldn't just be part of the group of ECL of Yuchel. Okay. All right, so this is the Machlokas, the Gra, and Rashi, how to learn the first pasuk. Now, again, just go over this quickly. The beginning of the psukim talks about how bereft, how chaser of wisdom he is. Kibara neichi meyish. I am a bar. A bar means I am, a bar is like a boor. I am uncouth, uncultured. I am coarse, without knowledge. I am more ignorant than any other man. Lo binas adam li. I don't have the bina of an adam. Lo lamadati chachma. I have not learned wisdom. Vidas kadeshim eda. And the knowledge of the holy ones. Eda, I mean, I don't know. Meaning the low is continuous. Lo lamadati. So the Gra explains that basically he is saying that he's expressing the idea, which we know, of course, from so many places, of Niskatnu Hadaris. Because the central issue here is that we really have no way of understanding the Darchei Hashem. We look at the world, we want to understand how does Hashem run the world, and we want explanations, we want to understand why this person suffers and that person prospers. And the overall thesis of Ogur Ben Yochah is that it's not possible for a person to truly understand the Darchei Hashem. Again, we would simply say that the finite cannot comprehend the infinite. And therefore, Hashem's is infinite. I'm sure Rabbi Gottlieb must have talked about this many times. You know, there was a famous novel written in the 1890s, Flatland. It was very popular then, and still scientists like to refer to it a lot. Flatland referred to a world where everything was two-dimensional. And he describes, it's hard for us to imagine ourselves down either, because we can't imagine a world that's six-dimensional. It's hard for us to imagine what it's like, but the novel goes through a few hundred pages describing what it's like just to be two-dimensional. And what would happen if a two-dimensional entity would somehow perceive something three-dimensional? How would they take it in? And the author goes through, you know, it's a bit complicated, actually, but he says, they wouldn't visualize the three. In other words, it's not like you're two-dimensional and you see this as three-dimensional. You literally don't see it that way at all. You see it in some way to make it fit your world. Now, physicists say that the world itself is much more than three dimensions. Physicists say, these are physicists, they sound like Mekubalim today. Physicists say, the world may have 26 dimensions. Yeah, ask them. they don't know either, but that's exactly right. We only know what we see, but we see so little, right? So this is an amazing thing. You know, I knew a professor of physics who was a fun person. He's not alive anymore. He was a Sephardic person, and he used to go to... He had an interest in Kabbalah a little bit, so he was a shtickel mekubal. I mean, shtickel mekubal on some level. So he used to go to the mekubalim in Beis El here. He is a yeshiva mekubalim here in Yerushalayim. So they would, every few years he would visit them, and they would ask him what he's working on in physics. So he would say, crystals, this and that. So they typically, oh, that's where you're up to. Okay, good. So keep on working. You know, it's like... So be it as may, the point is that just as a two-dimension cannot understand three-dimension, and a three-dimension doesn't understand 26-dimension. So it's not sad. Kal v'chomer, Darchei Hashem is beyond us. Elamai, this is why we need Mesorah, right? What is Mesorah? So Mesorah gives us certain fundamental truths in life that even though we can't automatically prove it, we can't understand it, but we know that this is the MS that is passed down. And that's why we say Niskatnu Hadaris. Not because the generations get inferior. It's not because IQs are lower. Although that's an interesting study. Some have actually said. In other words, if you took the average person 500 years ago, they wouldn't be a super genius. Right? The claim is not necessarily that people in the olden times were smarter. Although, as I say, there actually is some psychological research that's totally a part of this that says that the average IQ is 10 points lower than it was 100 years ago. That people used to just use, these are goyim, I'm not talking about Jews. People used to just have to carry more information in their minds. Today we have, you know, internet, we don't have to know anything. We don't have to know how to write or add, right? We have calculators. That people just used to their mind, their minds were faster, they could, you know. And it's true or not, you can think about this. If you, huh? People don't have to think, right. And it's true, the truth is, if you meet the people from the older generation, they just like, their minds work a little faster. It just happens to be true. We've dumbed down. But putting that aside, it's lav davka that people were super geniuses. But the pshat is, they were closer to the Messiah. They were closer to Maimon Har Sinai. And therefore, there was a spiritual emes in what they understood that gets lost and weakened. So Memela, Ogur Bin Yoke is referring to the notion that we lose things as we go through time. And he points out, Bar Anochi Me'ish is Yaakov Avinu. Right? Meaning, Yaakov is called Ishtam. I am not as great as Yaakov. I don't have the Bina of Yitzchak, right? So Binas Adam is Yitzchak. Chochma is Avraham. And then Das Kedashim, the Kedashim are the Shevatim. Now again, so according to this, the progression that he's emphasizing is Ish is Yaakov, Bina is Yitzchak, Chachma is Avraham, Kedashim is the Shevatim. He's comparing himself to all of these different levels. And the Gra points out that when you look at the qualities for Shevatim, when Yisro told Moshe Rabbeinu to look for Shaiftim, so he says, Havu lachem anashim chachamim nevonim yiduim l'shifteichem. In other words, it's very interesting. Anashim means great people in Midas, chachamim, nevonim, and yiduim. That corresponds exactly the four qualities here. Ish is anashim. The next one is Bina, the third one is Chachma, and Das Kedashim is Yiduin. Right? So the Gra points out that in a sense, the qualities of the ideal Shofet should mirror these qualities. Now the one thing the Gra does not develop so much here is, he doesn't develop why the Midah of Ish is connected to Yaakov, and the Midah of Bina is Yitzchak, and Chachma is Avram. That he's not Marichan so much, but he does say that these represent the four qualities of a leader, of a shofet, of a chacham, that ish is in midas, and then bina is the ability to understand one thing from another, chachma is the concept of getting knowledge, and das is what we would call emotional intuitive understanding. It's very interesting that because a shofet, anyone really, whether it's a parent, a teacher, a shofet, doesn't just have knowledge that operates from the brain, but there has to be a certain intuition as well. For example, the Chazon Ish used to say that even in halacha, there is something called a hergesh halev. There are svaras sometimes, which you can't prove that a certain svara is right or wrong. But if a person is connected to the Torah in a strong enough way, there will be a certain hergesh of what is right and what is wrong. Chazon Ish called that the fifth chelak of Shulchan Aruch. Right? There's the fourth chelakim of Shulchan Aruch, and there's a fifth chelak of Shulchan Aruch. Even in the most simple case, when a dayan has a case, sometimes you can have kosher witnesses, 100%, but the dayan has a hergish that the witnesses are lying. And he can't even say why. But that's an important thing. That's an akuda being connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, so those are the qualities of Dayanim. Okay. So essentially, though, what is the Pasuk telling you? The Pasuk is basically saying, Niskatnu Adairis. Okay, I mean, he's using this imagery, but it's Niskatnu Adairis. Now, he then asks four rhetorical questions. And I'll first tell you what this could mean, Al-P, simple pshat, and then how the Gra changes a little bit. Mi Ola Shamayim Vayeret. Who has gone up to heaven and come down to report about it? Meaning, how do I understand the ways of Hashem? Have I been in Shamayim and checked it out? Second question. Mi asaf ruach bechafnav. Who has gathered the wind in his hands? As if to say, to try to understand Shamayim would be as fruitless as trying to grab the wind with my hands. Can't do it. That's the way a poet would speak. To try to understand the Darchei Shamayim is like trying to grab air with your hands. Mi hekim kol afseyaret. Who has been able to establish all the... I'm sorry. Mi tsorar mayim besimla. Who has gathered water in a garment? Now, well, sometimes, you know, if you fall into a pond, maybe your jacket could be waterlogged. But basically, the idea is that in Tehillim, it's described in Baruch Nafshi, that Hashem, as it were, can gather up all the water as if it's in his garment. Like, imagine he has a coat that's filled with water. Right? Who else who has done that? Meaning the concept, once again, is if you can't do what Hashem does, you can't understand Hashem. Mi hekim kolap seyaret, who has established the ends of the earth, who has kept the earth going. Mashmo mashem benav. Give me his name, and give me the name of his son. Ki seida, if you know. So in other words, so the simple meaning of this pasuk is that no one has been able to check out HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shemayim, and nobody can do what he does, and if nobody can do what he does, there's no way you can understand it. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lives, exists, on a level that's beyond our comprehension because we have no way of emulating. Meaning, as the philosopher stated, if we understood Hashem, we would have to be Hashem. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not Shaykh. But the Gra takes a little differently. The Gra actually says, this is not describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is actually describing the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu, which actually ties in. Because after Ogur ben Yochez says, I don't have the knowledge and perception of the Avos and the Shvatim, look at the connection. The Avos and the Shvatim lived before Matan Torah. So what was their connection to God? Their connection to God was through their own seichel, their own understanding. Now, yes, it's true, Chazal say they kept the whole Torah ad shelo nitna, but they intuited the Torah. We can't even understand this. The same way, what does it mean the Avos kept the whole Torah ad shelo nitna? This is an amazing idea. The same way that we understand intuitively, basically, you're not supposed to kill. You know, it's wrong to kill because that's basic decency that's built into our conscience. The Avos understood you can't mix wool and linen. They understood that the world requires that we wear leather boxes with certain verses in them, certain ideas in them. Now, this is an unbelievable madrega. They understood. It's not that God commanded them. In point of fact, they were not commanded. But they understood. They looked at the world and they said, this is what keeps the world going. This is what brings Hashem into the world. This is what brings bracha into the world. And when this isn't done, you know, there is no holiness in the world. They understood. Now, what he's saying is, we don't have, or he's saying it himself, but we don't have the understanding to figure this out ourselves. And that is why there had to be a Matan Torah. Revelation was necessary because the Jairus reached a Madrega where they could no longer intuit through their own understanding the Ratzon Hashem. So that's why he switches after saying, I'm not on the Madrega of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, or the Shvatim even. We need Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah. So now he's Mishabeach Moshe Rabbeinu in the following way. He says there are four great chasadim that Moshe Rabbeinu did for Am Yisrael. And not necessarily in order here, he says, but based on the way the Pesukim are describing it, Matan Torah. Then he says, let me find the list here. Yeah, his list is Horid HaTorah. He brought us the Torah. Vahaluchais. And he brought us the Luchais. Now let me explain why these are two different things. The Torah itself is the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. The Luchais only have the Aseret HaDibros, but the Luchais refer primarily to the idea that after the Luchos were broken because of the Chedo Egel, Moshe Rabbeinu prayed, and on Yom Kippur brought down the Luchos Shniyah. So the Luchais means the gift of Tshuva. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu brought Torah to us. Moshe Rabbeinu brought Tshuva. Actually, he didn't bring Tshuva, we did Tshuva, but he brought Kapara for us. That's what he means by Luchais. Going backwards, Yitzias Mitzrayim, which culminated in Kriyas Yamsuf. And the last one was Hakamas HaMishkan, that brought the Shekhinah into the world. Right. So if you had to summarize Moshe Rabbeinu's accomplishments, the Gras says, again, this is the order that he's going to follow in the Pesukim, that we have Matan Torah, we have the Luchais, which represents forgiveness for Am Yisrael, we have the Kriyas Yamsuf, which is Tzias Mitzrayim, and we have Hakamas HaMishkan. So the Gra says very beautifully that this is Merumas in these Psukim. Who went up to Shamayim and came down? It's not a rhetorical question. It actually is making, in other words, he's not making the point that nobody ever did. He's saying one person did. It was Moshe Rabbeinu. And remember, it's described very dramatically in Maseches Shabbos, how the Malachi HaShoreis did not want to let him take the Torah down to the people. He says, why are you giving the Torah to people who are going to violate it and break it? Keep the Torah in Shemayim. No, Rav Volmanzatzal used to say, this is very, very, very powerful thing. Think about it every Simchas Torah. You know, in Simchas Torah, there's a widespread minhag. You know, even in the Young Israel shuls, you know, I remember the shuls I grew up in, that when they put when they try to put back the Torah, Susha and Mershecha, at the end of Hakatos, so there are people who block it, and the Torah gets pulled back. Now, I always thought that was because the older people wanted to end Hakatos, and the younger people keep on going. In fact, you know, I was a rabbi of a shul for 22 years, so it's interesting that one of the things I remember is I was there long enough to remember the people who used to want to continue Hakabas, they became the people who then tried to stop them. Again, it's interesting to see the shift in, you know, what you want to do, because young people want to keep on going, and old people want to shorten it, right? So that's why you find some people that want to put it back. But Rav Bumman said a beautiful, beautiful thing. I don't know if it was his chiddush or not. He said that this is reenacting the struggle between the Malachi HaShoreis and Moshe Rabbeinu, because the Aron HaKodesh is like the heavens. You're putting the Torah back in Shemayim. So the angels are trying to take the Torah back, and we're trying to pull it back to us, as it were. You're reenacting the struggle of Matan Torah in and of itself. So it's a very powerful point. And to this day, by the way.
So it comes out that reverse.
Well, eventually we have to put it back. Yeah, well, I don't know what the alternative practically is going to be. But to this very day, maybe you've seen this, when an Adam Gadol is Nifter, so on the signs, on the Pashkevimim, there's a phrase, and maybe you may not know where the phrase comes from, Nitzchu ho'arelim es hametsukim. It's a phrase. It's not a common phrase, but it's a phrase taken from the Navi Yeshayahu. Nitzchu ha'arelim, the angels have been victorious over the mitzukim, over those who are on earth. So it actually describes the Petira of Tzaddik also as we're trying to keep him, we're trying to keep the neshama, and the Malachi HaShoreis triumph over us. And that's the sadness of Nitzchu, look for that pasuk next time you see a poster. Nitzchu ha'arelim es ha'mitzukim. And Rav Bowman was saying that exactly is kind of that struggle. But okay, so the Gra says, Ni Allah Shemayim v'yere. Who is the only person who went to Shemayim to bring down the Torah? Moshe Rabbeinu. Ni Osaf Ruach b'chafna. So here's what the Gra says. Instead of translating it, who could hold on to air with his hands? The Gra says the following. Ruach refers to Ruach HaKodesh, Ruach Nevuah. Now, here is the interesting point. At Matan Torah, the Jewish people reached, actually, not even before Matan Torah, from Yetzias Mitzrayim, it says the Jewish people reached the highest level of Nevuah. What does the Gemara say? That the maidservant saw at the time of Kriyas Yamsa what Yechezkel, more than Yechezkel, saw at the Maisim Rekava. Right?
Did they say
Yechezkel
because he was the highest
Navi? Yeah, well, Yechezkel's Nevuah is the most explicit and clear. Again, the Gemara actually says Yeshayahu saw everything Yechezkel saw, but Yeshayahu was like somebody who was in that, he was like the Tsar, the prime minister who saw the king every day, so he wasn't so amazed. Yechezkel saw it less often, so it was more vivid to him. But Yechezkel is the most explicit about what the Kisei HaKavod looks like.
His Nevuah was more clear than Shmuel Amalek?
When I say more clear, I mean it's more explicit. Now, what Shmuel saw, we don't know, but Shmuel does not record anything that he saw. I mean, you look at the book of Shmuel, you don't have anything in the book of Shmuel that describes the Kisei HaKavod. Now, what Shmuel saw, that's another thing. According to Chazal, Shmuel was shakal, was as great as Moshe and Aaron. But Yechezkel is the Navi who is most beferish about the Maisa and Merkava, so we use him as the example of someone who sees everything. So what happened was, the Chedo Egel, what happened to Chedo Egel? We lost our Nevuah. We became excommunicated. When Moshe Rabbeinu brought down the Luchas, Shnios, we were restored to the Madrega of Nevuah. So now look how the Pasuk says, Mi Asaf Ruach B'chafna. Who gathered Ruach HaKodesh in his hands? What's in his hands? The Luchas. Moshe brought the Luchas back. And by that forgiveness of Am Yisrael on Yom Kippur, he brought Ruach HaKodesh back to Klal Yisrael. Right? So that's a reference to that. The Ruach means the Ruach Nevuah. Mi Tsarar Mayim B'Simla, who gathered up all the water as if it's in a single bag or garment. That's a reference to Kriyas Yamsa, which is Yitzias Yitzrayim. Now again, why the order here is a little problematical. I mean, if you're going chronologically, you would mention Yetzias Mitzrayim first. Now, Mi Hakim Kolapse Aretz, who established the ends of the earth? This is a remez to Hakamas HaMishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu was minded to Mishkan, and we're told in the merit of the Mishkan, the whole heaven and earth survived and they exist, right? So, therefore, it's describing Ma Shmo Ma Shein B'nai. What is his name? Meaning, as opposed to the pshat, there's nobody. He was saying, remember Moshe? And then he says, and Shein B'nai. Now, Shein B'nai, Moshe Rabbeinu did have sons, Gershon and Eliezer. But the Gras says a different pshat here. The Gras says the following. This could very well have been autobiographical. He says, in every generation, the neshama of Moshe Rabbeinu is in the soul of the Talmud Chacham, that's the Gadol Hadar. And that Talmud Chacham is said to be the soul, the son of Moshe Rabbeinu. So what Ogur bin Yochez is saying is, we can't rely on our seichel. We need the Messiah from Moshe Rabbeinu. But we also have to know that in every generation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a nitzutz, a spark of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now the Yemma says, the Zohar says even more than the Gra quotes here. The Zohar says, every Talmud Chacham, every, not Zagrasa, just the Gadol Hador, says every Talmud Chacham has a spark of Moshe Rabbeinu. Is Pashtusa L'Moshe B'chol Dor. This is why there's a concept, there is something mystical. I mean, there is something mystical about the people that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses to be the poskim of the generation. Where do they tell the story? They tell the story that this may be, I'm not sure if it's a true story, I don't know if it's a true story, but you know, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Brisker, was considered to be the Gadol Hador by many people. If, you know, I mean, he's not for me to even say. He was phenomenally great in Gadlus, Tyre, and Amkus, and Eon. The whole Derech of Yeshivas is based on Rav Chaim's Derech. Of course, it got corrupted to a great degree, but you know, Rav Chaim was the yisayid of the deep, deep, deep Havanas HaTorah. He was also a Mishnah Dik Baal Chesed. It's very interesting. He died in Warsaw. You know, the cemetery in Warsaw, other than, is the second largest Jewish cemetery in the world. The largest is Harazesa. The second is Warsaw. Now, why did so many Gedolim die in Warsaw? They didn't live in Warsaw, but they came to Warsaw. It was a big city. It had medical treatment. So a lot of Gedolim came to Warsaw, and they died shortly afterwards, and they were buried there. So Rav Chaim, the Nitziv, they didn't live in Warsaw at all, but they died in Warsaw because they went there for medical treatment. On Rav Chaim's kever, all the things it could have said, we know Rav Chaim for his tremendous, tremendous eon and understanding. They called him Isha Chesed. He was actually more meforsim, even for his Chesed. The Velt used to say there were two Gedolim that the world does not really appreciate. The Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim. Everyone thinks of the Chafetz Chaim as a tzaddik and not a gaon. And everybody thinks of Rav Chaim as a gaon and not a tzaddik. But in fact, Rav Chaim was a bigger tzaddik than he even was a gaon. And the Chafetz Chaim was a bigger gaon than he was a tzaddik. People don't associate to them. Chavetz Chaim is known for his sitkas. We don't realize. If you ever, I mean, when you learn the Mishnah Berurah properly in the Ber Halacha, you know, if you take a sugya that you learn in Maseches Shabbos, your Maseches Brachos, and after you learn the sugya with Rishonim, you go to the Ber Halacha, you will see what phenomenally. What the Mishnah Berurah is in terms of going through a sugya and extracting a halacha, always based on, you know, the oimek of a sugya, tremendous, tremendous thing. So the story goes this way though. The one thing Rav Chaim didn't like to do, Rav Chaim was the Rav of Brisk. Rav Chaim hated to paskin shailas. Rav Chaim did not want to paskin a shaila. He didn't want to paskin at all. People still speculate, you know, from whence came this like total reluctance to Paskin, probably because Rav Chaim was a very independent person. Everything had to be Eiskahalten with Svara. And in Psak, sometimes you have to follow the precedent of the Nisei Kalim of the Shulchan Aruch. So Rav Chaim didn't want to Paskin not like them, but he didn't want to Paskin like them because it was connected his Seichel. So he had other people Paskin. He had Dayan and he had people in Brisky. He did not want to Paskin at all. Although the few times we have Pesachim from him, they're absolutely phenomenally brilliant, but he did not want to pass them. So the story goes, the Pesach Hador in Rav Chaim's time, the Pesach Hador, was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. I don't know if you've heard of Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Yitzchak Elchanan, YU is named after him, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. And Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was the Pesach Hador, but he also was an Askenim, and he really worked for the Jews in Russia during very difficult times. In fact, he was so beloved that many people had a picture of him in their house. So the story goes, it might be a fake story, that Rav Chaim used to send the hardest shailas to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and he would say to him, just send me a yes or no, don't give me any svara at all. Don't give me any svara. He says, what's the pshat? So the pshat of the story is this, that if you give me a svara, I'm probably going to disagree with you. Because I have a different mahalach, I have different ways of looking at it. But because you are the Pesach Hador, I know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give you the right answer, even if your svar is wrong. It says, so I'm miming, I have total faith that you will be machriya correctly. That's what they said to start. Now they said the Nadav Yehuda, when was one of the great, Nadav Yehuda was the Rav of Prague in the 1700s, and really one of the Gedolei Achreinim, great, great Pesach, Nadav Yehuda, that when he was being interviewed for the position of the Rabbanus of Prague, there were some Balabatim in Prague who didn't like it. They wanted the job. They were Chachar Tamil Chachamim, and they felt that they should get the job. There was a famous Talmud Chacham in Prague who was a businessman, but he felt, you know, he was Roy for Rabbanus. He was a great Talmud Chacham. So he would make up the hardest shailas to ask the Nadav Yehuda, the hardest shailas. And the Nadav was always able to answer, but one time he couldn't answer it right away. he said, you made it up. And this Talmud Chacham always said these were real shailas. Rebbe Yehuda says, you made that up. Says, how do you know? He says, because I know when something is nogea l'maisa, when something has to be answered, the Eibishter gives me siyata d'shmaya, and I'm able to see an answer. If I don't see an answer, it's because it's a theoretical, you made it up, so it's not nogea anybody, so I don't have siyata d'shmaya. There is a concept that the Paisek is given a siyata d'shmaya because Am Yisrael needs guidance. If it's a purely theoretical thing that, it's a once in a million thing that didn't happen, it's not going to happen. So maybe the Siyata Vishmaya is less in such a nightmare. So this is his taina. This is the taina that you don't only look at the Mesera from Moshe Rabbeinu, but you have to look at the son of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is the Ispachtusa de Moshe B'chaldor, and at least in the Lashon of the Gra, the Talmud Chacham, which is the Gadol Shebador, is called the son of Moshe. By the way, the Gra's Talmidim applied this in an interesting way. You know that the Gra actually left Vilna to come to Eretz Yisrael. And he never made the trip. He got as far as Amsterdam, although it's very, very strange. Amsterdam is not on the way from Vilna to Eretz Yisrael. But okay, it's a whole story. But in Amsterdam, he turned back. The story they tell is that they say that the Gra wanted to find in Amsterdam manuscripts of the Ramchal, which would be Makar of the Geula. Okay, they connected to that. The Ramchal was a great Makobel, and he had already died. Okay. The Gra did not make it, but the Talmid they had brought did come to Eretz Yisrael. In fact, that's why Yerushalayim, the Minhagim of Ashkenazim and Yerushalayim, follow the Gra so much. For example, we don't say B'shomru, all those things that we don't say are based on, or the Shir Shal Yom, when it's a yomtiv for something, so the Minhag HaGra is not to say the regular Shir Shal Yom. All of those things that are different than your shuls back home, that's based on the Minhagim of the Gra. So the Talmidim used to say that because the Gra was a Gilgal of Moshe Rabbeinu, so the same way Moshe Rabbeinu could not enter Eretz Yisrael, the Gra could not enter, so he was Bichlal the Gezera, that he couldn't come to Eretz Yisrael. The Talmidim were Yoshua, so they were able to enter. That's what they say. But again, that's not so miyushu, because the Gra says every Gadol Hadar is a Mitzvah of Moshe, Rabbi Yashuv made it. That's so you can't automatically say it. But at least the Gra himself is that way. Okay. He goes on, Ogur goes on and says, Kol Imras Elokat Zerufa, Magehu Lachaisim Bai. All the words of God, Imras Eloka, all the words of God are Tzirufa. Tzirufa means pure, right? When you have metal, and metal has impurities, and in order to purify the metal, if it's gold or silver or copper or iron, you have to burn away the little rocks or pieces of minerals that are defects, dross. But when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, there is nothing that is impure. There is nothing that is bad about it. The whole thing is 100% precious. And Mogein Hu, it is a shield. Lachosin Bo. Now again, how do you translate? Chosin means those who seek refuge. Now, just in terms of literal translation, Chosin Bo. Is Bo going on the Imras Eloka, which is the Torah, or is it going on Hashem? In other words, Mogeinu L'chosin Bo, does it mean it is a shield to those who seek refuge in it? Or does it mean he is a shield to those who seek refuge in him? In other words, is the subject of the second phrase Imras Eloka, which means the Torah, or is it Eloka? Is it going on the Ribbono Shel Olam itself? Right? Interpretively, you can learn it two ways. The Gra learns that it's going on the Torah, and it refers to the idea. I stand corrected. It is actually going on Hashem, and Chosin Bo refers to the Midah Bitachon. In other words, Imras Eloka is the purity of the Torah. Magin Olachosimah, and the Gra says, This is the, what you might call the Chayvas HaLevavos, is sketch 22. The Chayvas HaLevavos writes that the level of Hashgacha Pratis that Hashem shows you in your life is taloi on how strong your faith is in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The more I believe that Hashem watches over me and protects me, the more I will see and feel the protection of Hashem. The less, that's why it's called the Catch 22, because let's say a person doesn't believe in Hashem. So he's not going to see Hashem protecting him. So then he'll believe less in Hashem. Then he'll see Hashem protecting him less. In other words, he's going to be confirmed in his feeling Hashem is not watching him, because Hashem responds to his lack of emunah. So that's what the pasuk is saying. Magen hu, Hashem is a shield for those who seek refuge in him. Meaning, when you have that bitachon, Hashem is going to protect you. When you don't have that bitachon, then there's going to be hester upon him. So it has to start with you. You have to have that bitachon. When you have that bitachon, you will see in your life the protection of Hashem. You know, they tell the story of Vardak. This was actually Machlekes, the Chazon Ish and the Baalei Musar. Yeah.
Rabbi Akiva, he had a lot of bitachon, but, you know, he got hurt at the end of his life.
No. So this was an interesting Machlekes between, you know, the Chazon Ish wrote a beautiful sefer that was printed after his death, on Emuno Bitachon. I don't know if you've seen it. They've translated it in English, too. These are reflections on Emunah and Bitachon. And it actually was a controversial, it is a bit of a controversial sefer. And some of it was censored. I don't know if they put it back in there. I think you probably still print the censored editions. The original Ksav Yad of the Chazon Ish was a strong critique of a certain shita of the Muslim movement. And they took it out because it was too stark of a critique. But the particular critique was the critique of the Shita of Nevardik. Nevardik was a Shita of Moshe that emphasized Bitachon. And they basically said, if you're a Baal Bitachon, nothing bad will happen to you. If you truly are a Baal Bitachon, you are protected. And if something bad happens, it's because you were not a Baal Bitachon. This was the Nevardik Shita. The Chazon Ish says that's totally wrong. The Chazon Ish said that's wrong. The Chazon Ish brings Rabbi Akiva, he brings all sorts of situations. The Chazon Ish says, Bitachon doesn't mean I know everything will be happy ending. Bitachon means I believe everything comes from Hashem for a good purpose. See, Gamzul Tova doesn't mean it'll turn out the way I like it to turn out. But it means, even if it turns out with suffering and death and destruction and sickness, I believe there's a purpose, there's a tachlis, and there's a good. And the Chazon Ish was very critical. He said that the Nevardik Hashgacha he felt could take people away from Hashem. Because what happens is, I mean, you see this a lot. You know, you're davening that a person shouldn't die, and they die. It's hard to say. I mean, L'chara, even the altar of Nevardik understood that sometimes things happen. So the Chazon Ish was very, very critical of this Shita. And he said, Bitachon is the idea that everything is from Hashem for a purpose, but it doesn't mean automatically things are going to be a happy ending. But still, the emes is, the more, I'll give you a story about Nevardik that illustrates this a little bit. It's a cute story. Rav Gershon Liebman, Zatzal, was a Talmud of the Altar of Nevardik, and by the way, the Stipler was a Talmud. The Stipler, his yeshiva was Nevardik. He actually was a Talmud of the Altar of Nevardik, and he became a Rosh Yeshiva in Nevardik. So that's interesting. The Nevardik is although the Stipler didn't become totally a Nevardiker, but that Hashkafa has a resonance, and then through Rav Chaim, etc., and the like. But Gershon Liebman was the Rosh Yeshiva of a Nevardik yeshiva in France. And Rav Gershon Liebman developed an aversion to money. He couldn't stand money, because money was the symbol of a person's gaiva, of a person thinking, I don't need Hashem. So he had to collect money for his yeshiva all the time. But the problem is, money made him vomit. guy's physically sick. So he had to have somebody with him to collect the money. He could not touch money. But the start at being where she was, actually, if you can't touch money, being where she was a very bad job. It's a big, it's like, Rav Schiller would be in a lot of trouble. Couldn't do that. But the thing is that he also believed that he was a total Baal Bitachon. So when he would come to New York, he would come with no money at all. He would not come with money for a cab or anything else. So he shows up to the airports. He shows up at Kennedy Airport after a trip from Paris. And one of his talmidim happens to be in the airport and says, can I give Rosh Yeshiva a ride? He says, yeah, sure. So he doesn't know how to bring it up. And in the middle of the ride, he says, you know, Rabbi, I'm just wondering, you know, was somebody supposed to pick Rosh Yeshiva up? He says, no. He says, if I wouldn't have been here, what would have happened? He says, you're here, aren't you? He says, I knew something would be here. You know, was that kedekach? Like you had this total bitachon. You didn't do any shtadlus, any preparation at all. That was the right. It was a very extreme shita. The Chazon Ish had a problem with it because he thought that if a person has that type of enthusiasm, as wonderful as it is, then he might lose his emunah chas v'shalom when things don't turn out in that miraculous way. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the milo bitachon. Bitachon is a tremendous thing. And as the Chaim Soloveitchik says, in through bitachon one is zeicha to a tremendous closeness and a feeling of Hashem in his life. You will notice things more. The more bitachon you have, the more you will see the Yad Hashem in your life. Without bitachon, you're going to see it less and less. So the Gros says that two things are being stated here, that all of the Torah is perfect, and that's an important idea. Because we sometimes look at parts of the Torah and we say, oh, that's less important and that's more important, this is more interesting. Now, of course, every person has mashal libo chafetz. But the answer is, even in the most technical, chas v'shalom, you might think, boring parts of Torah, there is purity and light that can lift you or can lift you, etc. Okay. So now, he says, because Hashem's Torah is so perfect, Al Taisif al Devarav. Do not try to add on to Hashem's Torah. Do not try to improve it. Now, of course, the kasha this pasuk raises is the same kasha as the Torah raises. Now, the Torah itself gives us a lav in the Torah. Do not add on to the Torah, right? Lo Taisif. And don't take away from the Torah. Right? As we added, don't take away from the Torah. That might be obvious. Don't take away, but adding. People ask the question, right, what are drabbanans if not additions to the Torah? Right, the Torah says don't cook meat and milk. We say you got to wait 6 hours. The Torah says it only applies to mammals, to animal, to meat. And Chazal say it applies to chicken. Right, I mean, every drabbanan, muktzah, every drabbanan is adding to the Torah something that would be permitted. So the obvious question is, if there's a lav in the Torah called Baal Taisif, how is it ever shayach for the Chachamim to make any gezeres or takanas? So one answer the Rishonim give may sound a little circular, and that is, since one of the mitzvahs of the Torah is to listen to the Chachamim, that's a mitzvah in the Torah, lay sasur, do not turn away, so when I am listening to the Chachamim, I'm not adding to the Torah, I am fulfilling the mitzvah in the Torah to listen to the Chachamim. So a takanas chazal is by definition not a haisafa, because it is nichlal in the obligation of listening to the Chachamim. Now, the Emma says you can question the logic of that teretz, because the logic of that teretz might say, why I, who am listening to the Rabbanan, I am not transgressing, adding to the Torah, because I am listening to the mitzvah of obeying the Chachamim, which is in the Torah. So mitzad me, I'm not over on Baal Taisif. But the question is, why aren't they over on Baal Taisif? Right, by adding something. Okay. But another teretz, the Rashba says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, is, this is an interesting idea. This is why the halachic system must differentiate between Drabbanims and Doraisas, right? L'chaira, I have to keep a Drabban and I have to keep a Doraisa. So why do we have different rules for Rabbanans and Doraisas? On a Doraisa, we say, for example, if there's a doubt, if I benched or not, I got to bench again. If it's because that's a Doraisa. If I'm in doubt, if I say Kriya Shema, I got to say Shema again. If I'm in doubt whether I daven Shemona Esra, I don't daven again, because that's Drabbanim. L'chaira, why should there be these differences? The Rashba says you have to have those differences to clearly indicate that it's a Drabbanan and not a Doraisa. The issue of Lotaisif is only when you make the Rabbanan equal to the Doraisa. But when you demarcate as a Drabbanan, you're not adding on to the Torah.
So we say sometimes that the Rabbanans are even
more. Sometimes we do that, that's correct. Sometimes we're even more machmer. That's a good catch on the Rashba a little bit. But he says that as a general category, we make Rabbanans different than Doraisas. Right, so that's an important rule. So the need to make Rabbanans different than a Doraisa is the technical way where fences around the Torah are not baltaisa. Basar b'chalav is a good example. You know, if you cook beef in milk, not only is it forbidden to eat, but it's forbidden to get hana. You cannot sell it to a guy. If you cook chicken in milk, which is only an issur d'rabbanan, it's usher to eat, but it's mutter b'hana, right? So why do you have that chilek? Because in order that it shouldn't be baltaisa, the chachamim have to make it more lenient. That's what the Rashba says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah. But the idea of not adding is not just referring to halachas like baltaisif. Not adding is also referring to philosophies, right? A person might want to bring in all sorts of ideas to modernize the Torah, make it more palatable, make it more attractive for the 21st century person and the like. So basically, Ogur ben Yoke is telling us, right, Shlomo HaMelech or Ogur ben Yoke, whoever he is telling us that don't feel you need to add anything. Within the Torah itself will be everything that you need for a meaningful life and a connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And don't try to think you can improve things. Pen yochiach b'cha, lest God will rebuke you, show you how wrong you are, v'nichsavta, and you will be sorely disappointed. Yourself, that you will see the failure of what you've done. Again, I mean, I don't want to get into a polemic against the reform movement or whatever it is, but you know, again, I mean, if you think about movements like the reform movement, right? So the reform movement, or conservative movement might be a better example. The conservative movement kind of had the attitude that, you know, Jews are, Judaism is hard, and there's so many opportunities in America for freedom that in order to attract Jews, we need to make things easier, allow them to drive to Shul on Shabbos, etc. Now, the whole goal was, because this is the way you're going to bring Jews to Judaism. But what has happened is that these movements are rapidly declining. You know, in the 1950s, conservative movements were huge, 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 huge. Many Orthodox synagogues were getting rid of their mechitzas because they figured there was no way that Torah would ever be popular in America, you know, and the like. Now what's happening is that the conservative reform movements are really dying movements. Now, I'm not going to say that we've reached a level where everybody's coming from. In fact, a lot of the hemorrhaging is the other way around, unfortunately, that through intermarriage and assimilation, they're not doing anything at all. But the point is, the only chelik of Klal Yisrael that's growing are Yidden that are keeping Torah. The other movements, they still have a lot of people because, you know, there were so many people there that even with the hemorrhaging, they're still around. But, you know, there is no fourth generation Reform family in existence, meaning to say, if somebody is a Reform Jew now, their great-grandchildren will not be identifiably Jewish at all. So, meaning, anybody that's a Reformed Jew now, 100 years ago, had religious relatives. Because if they would have been Reformed relatives, I mean, there were Reformed Jews 100 years ago, but what I'm saying is, anybody who was a Reformed Jew 100 years ago does not have a Jewish descendant. Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to say it's 100% true, but that's surprisingly true in a large percentage of cases.
Rabbi White said that the nowadays software community outnumber conservative community. And conservative community, for the first time, they're looking at Shabbos. They said, maybe we'll work to make, or maybe there is something to Shabbos.
No, that's right. Even the Reform movement. The Reform movement now is looking at becoming more traditional. Classical Reform, the old time Reform, you weren't allowed to wear a yarmulke. You had to take it off. You had to take it off. You were not allowed to wear a talit. You were not allowed to wear a yarmulke. You had to take it off. Now it's not that way. Now they wear a talus, and they do other things.
What about modern Orthodox?
What about? are they gaining?
No, what's your opinion about it? Like,
what's my opinion? Well, coming from a modern Orthodox show, depends how you define modern Orthodox. It depends what modern Orthodox. See, modern Orthodox is a very, very broad term. If modern Orthodox means an orthodoxy that also believes in people working and having a profession, no, that's Torah and Derech Eretz. That's not necessarily a problem. If it means a culture where you're Mekel and Halacha and Kolisha doesn't matter and you go to movies and everything else, then it becomes like a Kalish Reich and it's just an excuse for Kalish Reich. Now, it's certainly much, 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 much better than conservative Reform. I mean, a person is at least keeping the basic ideas. But I think in many cases, somebody once said it very nicely. They said that a person has to look at the purpose of his life as keeping mitzvahs. Sometimes in a modern Orthodox world, you look at mitzvahs as problems that you got to get around. In other words, I want to do something, but Nebuchadnezzar, Shabbos is a problem, and Kashrus is a problem, so I'm going to figure out a way where I can get around it. So when you look at Torah as an obstacle course, there's something wrong with the with Hashgacha. See, this is the thing. When they talk about Rav Soloveitchik as modern Orthodox, this was a totally different thing. He was a person who, he was a Gadol B'Torah, and he was a person who did believe that you can get Chochmas, that you can help in Torah. Little history here. You have Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, okay? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had four sons, but he had two sons who became famous. But they went in somewhat of a different derech. The oldest son was Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, who became the last Brisker Rav before the Holocaust. He came to Eretz Yisrael, and all of the Briskers in Eretz Yisrael are from him. And they're Kanoim, they're anti-Zionist, they're very stark, they're against secular studies, they're against college, they're very, very stark, very, very, very stark. Now, Rav Chaim's other son was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was also a big, big Talmud Chacham. But Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was more of a Zionist in some ways, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik also saw the value of secular wisdom in understanding Torah, although he himself did not go to college. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son was Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who came to America, and he became the Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University. And he represents the epitome. He is the biggest gadol the modern Orthodox community ever produced. And so what's interesting is the Briskers who live in Israel are anti-Zionist, and the Briskers who live in America are Zionists. The Zionists are in America, and the anti-Zionists are in Eretz Yisrael. And they don't talk to each other, although they both have the Brisker derech of learning, and they're both great Londonim. But between the Rav Moshe branch of the family and the Rav Velmel branch of the family, there is no peace. They have different shitas. So the question is, who is the authentic Yairish of Risk? That's a big machlokas.
According to the Torah, for a Jewish person to take an opportunity to live in Israel, is that something a person should strive for? Or at the moment we should wait till Mashiach, and if a person lives in the school, so it's perfectly fine?
Well, first of all, like this. First of all, even if you're in a Chuei Karta, even if you believe, and we could talk about this, that it's forbidden for Klal Yisrael to have a state of Israel until Mashiach comes, and there is such a shita. But that has nothing to do with living in Eretz Yisrael, even if you're living under a foreign domination. And the Ramban says that living in Eretz Yisrael is one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. You're chayiv to do it. And the Vilna Gaon, actually Paskins like the Ramban, although the Vilna Gaon was not able to make it. Other Rishayim say it's not a chiyuv, it's not an obligation, but it's still a very beautiful and proper thing. So I think everybody would say that it's either an obligation, which is Ramban, or it's a beautiful and proper thing, but there are heterim, there are situations in which you are exempt from it if you cannot make a living here. Now, I don't mean if you cannot make a living the way you do in America. If that would be the standard, nobody would live here at all. We're not talking about that. But you know, if you'd have to beg and collect money, you know, you should not come here if that's going to be the circumstance. And then there's issues of chinuch of your children, which sounds a little funny, but it is an issue. Sometimes if you have children, the chinuch for them might sometimes be better in the yeshiva they're in than coming to Israel, right? And if they're adolescents, there are issues. So I can't answer your question in the abstract, meaning a person should try to live in Israel, yeah, for sure. But he should talk to a rabbi there, because there are many, many circumstances where it may not be proper to make aliyah at a certain time in your life. But certainly if you're single, that's a good time to come, because you don't have the problem of uprooting your children and confusing your children and everything else again.
Going back to the reform thing, the fact that the population is dwindling and the Orthodox is growing, that's very interesting. It's not really proof which school of thought is right.
Yeah.
In fact, I was wondering, the rabbanim, they do sometimes, I know it's not, I'm not trying to compare it to the reform, but they do sometimes relax the law so that people would not violate something more strict, like...
No, that's very true. That's very true, of course, but not to Orishas usually. But that's true. But once again, it's within the methodology of Torah Shebal Peh, meaning to say, that's what the pasuk is saying. Don't try to improve Hashem's Torah, lest you be disappointed. So I'm trying to suggest a little bit that people think these improvements are going to make us stronger, when in fact they make us weaker, and then we see that what we thought we were going to accomplish, we're not accomplishing. But you're correct. I mean, again, one could ask a question. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, you go through, let's say Prisbal is in the audience. Some of you are learning Gittin. Yes. So there's a discussion of Prisbal, right? So Prisbal, the Torah says that if I lend you money and Shemitah comes, so Shemitah cancels out loans, you don't have to pay me. So Hillel saw a problem that rich people were not willing to lend money shortly before Shemitah because they were afraid that the Lova would just hold out a little bit and not have to pay. So rich people were transgressing the Aveira in the Torah of not hardening their hearts, and poor people couldn't get money. So what did Hillel do? Hillel created a mechanism that we use even today, that if I declare, if I'm a Malva, and I declare that I give my chov to a Beis Din who will give me rishus to collect it, the loan doesn't get canceled. Right, so Hillel changes the Torah. The Torah says the loan gets canceled, and Hillel says you can collect your loan. Wow. So the Gemara asks the question, right? How could Hillel be oker Dover min HaTorah? So according to one Teretz, it only works when the cancellation of the loan is Drabbanan. When Shemitah is Drabbanan, principle works. It wouldn't work when it's Daraisa. According to the other Teretz, when it comes to monetary matters, Hefker Beis Nefker, the Chachamim could say that the money that belongs to the Leiva, the Malva, has the right to collect. In other words, the point basically is, there is a methodology, there are rules. You can't just say, we want to make things easier for people. You know, in Baltimore, Baltimore's an unusual community. Baltimore had a psak. In the 1950s, Baltimore had my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ritterman Zatzal, asked two Rabbanim to investigate whether microphones are restaurant travelers. No, it's not so pasha. Now, what malacha are you doing when you speak into a microphone? It's not so pasha. So we asked Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who is his son-in-law, related to the Rosh Hashiva, and he asked another Rav in Baltimore. Rav Weinberg came to the conclusion it was usher, and the other Rav said it was mutter. So Baltimore had actually nominally Orthodox synagogues that used microphones on Shabbos, because they felt there was a psak for such a thing. And the shul that put in a microphone, it was a big shul, Beth Tefillah, the other shuls, they said, we have to do it, because we're not going to get members otherwise. We're not going to attract new people who want to service, you know. Now, what happened was, in Baltimore, these shuls with microphones were dying. Nobody was going to them. Anyone who was from wasn't going to the shul anymore. So around 15 years ago, a shul that had a microphone for 20, 30 years, took out the microphone because they said, we need to take out, and even though some of the old timers wanted the microphone, they said, nope, we have to take out the microphone because that's the only way we'll attract new members. So it's mamish, a fulfillment of this pasuk. You want to make tikkunim, you want to change things, you want to violate the halacha because you think you can make the Torah more popular. V'nichsavta, achsava, you're going to be disappointed. It's not going to work. Meaning, besides the fact that it's usher, we're not even saying that. Yeah, it's usher. That's enough of a reason not to do it. But more than that, what you think is going to create this hatzlacha is not going to work. You're not going to be makariv people by utilizing these ways that are connected to Ratzon Hashem. And therefore, don't think you can make the Torah better than it already is.
Did Russell Bishik compromise on anything?
Well, it depends how you understand it. The truth is, Rav Soloveitchik was very machmer in many, many inyanim. For example, the issue of mechitza, he said a number of times in writing also that if your only choice is to hear T.S. Schaefer in a show without a mechitza, or stay home and not hear Schaefer, then you stay at home. The truth is, he was more machmer. You know, the truth is, it's not so borrowed. And if you would ask me, what is the issue for me to hear T.S. Schaefer in a show without a mechitza? It's not at all possible that that's awesome. I mean, you know, I'm not davening. I'm hearing Schaefer in a mixed crowd. And certainly, if it would be a public school building without a service and we'd be hearing Schaefer with men and women, it would be okay. But he held that because this would give a legitimacy to this type of show, you have to worry about the long-term kiyum of Am Yisrael. And for that, it was kedai to miss Kiyah Schaefer. Now, did he compromise? See, it depends what you consider a compromise. From your perspective, it might be a compromise. From his perspective, it was okay. For example, he held it was all right for women to learn Gemara. Now, you could say that's a compromise. He held, according to Halakha, as much, you know, so it depends how you define one person's compromise is another person's psak. But he did not compromise. In other words, compromise means, I know it's usur, but I'm going to say it's okay. That he didn't do. I mean, he may have had psukim that other gedolim were not maskim to, but what he held was usher. He was very stark that it would be usher. Many of his talmidim did compromise. That's 100% true. But okay, whatever. That's you have to understand. America in the 1950s, conservatism was very, very strong. So many, many Orthodox rabbis took jobs in conservative synagogues. That was a common place.
For money,
they had no pronouncements. They did it, and it's a complicated story because they did some good in it. You know, there's a shul in Maryland, totally Orthodox rabbi. He was a rabbi of conservative, still conservative to this day. He was a rabbi for 50, 60 years, conservative synagogue. All of his children are Talmidei Chachamim and Rosh Hashivas, and he made many, many people from. He sent them away from his show. But he made many people cry. So after Me'ev Yisrim Shani, he goes to the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Kaddish Baruch Hu says, how could you be a rabbi in a conservative show for 60 years? He says, I made 100 families, Shomer Shabbos. How are you gonna balance that out? That's not for me to answer. But you know, it's a very, very hard question. But there is, you know, you never know. You never know what a Kaddish Baruch Hu is going to judge and kiss.
And also, sometimes people have an idea or could get it from another source, you know, like a true principle, and they try to find back for it in the Torah or in...
Yeah.
Is that a proper thing?
Well, Bukhari, you have to balance it. Essentially, this pasuk is not as straightforward as you might think, because on one hand, it says, don't add to the Torah, meaning don't think other ideas can help you in. On the other hand, we have the statement, Chachma Bagoyim Tamin. Chachma Bagoyim. If they tell you there is wisdom among the Goyim, you believe them. Which implies, in other words, there is something we can get from outside sources. Now, some might say, well, that's only technology, maybe. That's referring to, computers, cell phones, cars, that you can get from the Goyim. But ideas about morality and life, right, not. That was the Chazon Ish Shita, for example, and you might say that's the Graz Shita here too, the way he's interpreting the Pesukim. But No, it's Torah and Derech Eretz. Other shittas actually say that there are ideas you can get. So it's hard to figure out exactly Al Taisif Al Devarim there. You know, there are books that Mashkichim of Yeshivas tell Talmidim to read. I don't know if anyone here mentions that these are Geisha books that are not written with Torah sources at all, but Bali Machshava, Bali Musar consider them to be good books in building character and building mitzvos. One example is, this is the oldest book, is Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And the other is books by Stephen Covey. Stephen Covey happens to be a Mormon, but he writes the Seven Habits of Highly Efficient People, a few books like that. These are books that they say teach you Musar and discipline and character building and Tikkun HaMidas, and you can read them in the bathroom. You know, so there you see, there you see that there were, you know, Bali Musar who felt that you could, you know, benefit from this. Rav Volba, that was an outstanding tzaddik in Bal Musar. You know, Rav Volba was born in Germany. You know, Rav Volba went to university. He's not 100% true, but many say he's a Bal Tshuva himself, you know, years back. But during World War II, he was in Switzerland. Switzerland was a neutral country. That's how he managed to survive the war. But while he was in Switzerland, he worked for Jean Piaget. Now, Jean Piaget, not Jewish, was probably the greatest child psychiatrist of the 20th century. And Rav Volba had a shita that if he wanted to understand human personality, because part of being a Bal Musar is to understand how you work on your personality, how you change midos, says he wanted to work with this great psychologist or psychiatrist who had a great understanding. Actually, he was probably thinking psychologist. Who had a great understanding of personality and how it develops. Totally from a non-Jewish source, right? So you do see that people were willing to go and learn these things, not only in the realm of science, hard science, which was the Devar Pashut that we use, but even in the realm of... Well, we use science. I mean, people use a telephone, and even if you're against the internet, you know, if you have an iPhone, you don't have a chevuk and olim haba, that's what it says now. But you know, I'm saying we use science. I mean, we use telephones. We use we use a car. You know, the fact that a car was invented by whoever invented the car, we don't. I can't use it. It's goyish. You know, but what I'm saying is, it's one thing to say I can use the chachma of goyim on technological things. It's a much more difficult shaila if I can use the chachma of goyim in spiritual insight into working on my midos and the like. That's a more of a difficult idea, but we still see that Chachamim were willing to look to that also. The great danger is that, you know, if you're not doing it with Hadracha, you know, how are you going to know what is consistent with Torah, what is not consistent with Torah? That's an important problem. Because, you know, there's Chachma and there's stuff that's no good, right? So how do you know? So that already you need some guidance on that. Okay. But if you're asking me the Gra's own opinion, the way the Gra interprets the Pasuk, this is very consistent with the Gra's opinion. The Gra, by and large, was of the Shita that you don't use anything from the outside world, other than technology. The Gra did not have the Torah of Derech Eretz idea. He felt it was bottle. What does he say? The Gra says, the Gra's quoted, interesting enough, it says, he learned all of philosophy. He says he learned all the philosophy, and he only found two ideas that he thought were worthwhile in all the philosophy. Or he wrote somewhere, he says, all of the philosophers until Immanuel Kant were worthless. And then the Chazon Ish added, ad v'ad b'chlav, he says. Although, it's interesting, Immanuel Kant is a very, very deep philosopher. Wrote his most famous book is Critique of Pure Reason. It's a notorious, I never read it myself. It's a notoriously difficult book, Critique of Pure Reason. So that was Rav Elchanan's bathroom reading. Rav Elchanan, who read German, had Kant in the bathroom, so he could be.
That's what the Gra read?
Huh?
That's what the Gra read?
No, not the Gra, Rav Elchanan Wasserman. No, whether the Gra read Kant, I don't know. I mean, the Gra
said that the Gra said until...
Yeah, I'm not sure what the Gra read or didn't read. I mean, it wouldn't have been a problem for the Gra. The Gra could have read Kant in 2 minutes. On the other hand, the Gra didn't waste 2 minutes. You know, it's no, it would be no answer to the Gra to say, hey, you can do it in two minutes, because the Gra made a cheshbon of literally every minute. You know, the story goes with the Gra that he once went to a chasna somewhere. You know, the Gra's minhag for many years, not to the end of his life, but for many, many years, he only slept 2 hours a day, but it was spaced in 4 half-an-hour increments. So he never slept more than half an hour at a time. This was his shita. Yeah, he didn't want a shinas kavan, a little less than half. So when he went to this chasna, he went to sleep, and he slept 35 minutes. So when he woke up, he started crying. He was bizarre. He says, ay, 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 I come to this city. This city is a sleeping city, a city of sleep. And you have to know, when the Gra would come to a city, he didn't travel that much. People would stand around to watch him. In fact, he was like sleeping. Let's say his room was the second story of a building. They would put a ladder by the side of the building, and they would take turns so a person could watch the Gra learning for a few minutes. You know, so you climb up on a ladder, watch him learning for 5 minutes, then somebody else will climb up the ladder. Huh? Well, it's Osir, but you know, the Gemara gives a story, if you remember, the Gemara gives a story about one of Rav's Talmidim wanted to know about the proper way that a man is with his wife. So he put himself under the bed. So this Torah he learned, he wanted to learn, you know, learn all of these things. When they got up on the ladder and they saw the Gra crying, the whole city was sabrachim, like spread. And the Gra was like crying. He says, oh, yeah, I was mopsed 5 minutes in this city. How could I come to this city? And Mamish like tore them apart. But they were so honored that he came. So whatever it was, like 10 years later, he had to come to the same city. And he only slept 25 minutes. So the Gra got up and said, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the chance to be Messiah, with the whole simcha that they were redeemed, as it were. So the Gra could indeed, in fact, that's the cheshbon, the Gra could indeed learn anything in 2 minutes, but he didn't waste the 2 minutes. You know. Okay.
Well, did you think that he
can't? I don't know, he didn't say. He didn't say, unfortunately. Yeah, they do. The family name was Kramer. That was the name of the Gein's family. And when he was younger, the Gra went to Golis. So he actually wandered around different cities. As a kapara, kind of a non-Jew.
What's the reason why he did it?
Because it says that Golis, exile, is an atonement for sin. So it was the derech of tzaddikim hundreds of years ago that they would wander around like beggars.
But isn't that biblical Torah in a way? He was able to learn, he knew everything by heart.
He could learn on the road, you know, and that's not a problem. But he wandered around. In fact, he was even thrown in jail with the mice, and, you know, this and that. But so they say that he came to Germany and he met with some mathematics professors and he developed some theorems that they say in his name, Cramer's law. And the like. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter also had a son who was a famous mathematician. Lipkin was the family name, so there's something called the Lipkin parallelogram, which is Rabbi Shlomo Salanter's son. Unfortunately, he was not from, right? That's the whole other. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter's son was a son who was not from. It was a whole business. It was a source of great sorrow to Rabbi Shlomo. Yeah. Okay. All right, let me see the time. I don't want to keep you too late. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. We'll try to. Now that I'm here for a while, we can hopefully do this every week. Okay, but again, the basic idea once again is that what is this first unit? This first unit is basically saying that our own seichel is very limited. We need Torah. We need Gedolei Torah. And when we try to improve the Torah by adding our own conceptions, not only is it usher, that's one thing, but nichsap, you're going to be disappointed. It's not going to produce the thing that you want to produce, right? And as I say, that's unfortunately been borne out with the experience that I think we that we see. Okay? We're good.